Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Tonight, another Texas-sized last call. We're coming to you from day two of SMB Global CERAWeek Conference, the premier energy event of the year, filled with many of the most important players in business, energy, politics. And if you missed our show last night, don't worry. Tonight's might be even bigger because we are in Texas, after all, on deck. We're going to speak exclusively with Mike Wirth, chairman and CEO of Chevron, Ryan Lance, chair and CEO of ConocoPhillips, former BP CEO Bob Dudley, and Dan Yergin, maybe the world's foremost energy expert, and by the way, the man who built this very conference. Speaking of powerful energy, the record run for stocks is back on, and a vote that could help determine crypto's fate is underway in one state as we speak. All that and more over the hour, so belly up or buckle up from Houston. Last call is up right now. Hi, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan. We've got a huge hour ahead here live from CERAWeek. And first up, though, on last call tonight, stocks powering to all-time highs. The S&P 500 with a new record close as Wall Street and all you investors out there await tomorrow's Federal Reserve decision and what they indicate about rates in the future. Investors are going to be on the lookout for any kind of smoke signals on the future of rate cuts from Fed Chair Powell. The fuel for this historic rally, of course, has been, at least in the last couple of months, artificial intelligence. But that said, it was actually a pretty volatile day, bad day in some cases, for many chip stocks. Shares of NVIDIA did finish higher after recovering from early losses, but trader favorite Supermicro Computer and AMD, they fell sharply. Now, investors digesting NVIDIA's so-called the AI of Woodstock event, where the company unveiled its next generation of AI chips. And NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang spoke about it with Cramer last hour.
We improved the performance of one of these chips by 1,000 times in the last 8 years. We're in the beginning of this AI computing ramp.
And just a short time ago, NVIDIA also got a big endorsement from Elon Musk at the Abundance Summit while he was talking about AI.
You got to also give credit to Jensen and the NVIDIA team for kind of seeing this coming and making what at least currently is the best AI hardware out there.
Not to be outdone, even Saudi Arabia is getting in on the AI gold rush. The New York Times reporting tonight that the oil-rich kingdom is planning to create a $40 billion fund specifically to invest in artificial intelligence. All right, a lot of info there. And here's the big question maybe weighing on your mind tonight. Which one matters more to the stock rally right now? Is it the AI boom or is it rate cuts? Let's find out and talk about it with our lead market panel tonight. Joining us is Kobesi, letter editor-in-chief Adam Kobesi, and Seymour Asset Management CIO and Fast Money star and trader Tim Seymour. Tim, start us off. Answer the I did that just for Guy Adami. Answer the question, what do you think is more important to the macro market, AI or the Fed?
Well, if you look at the market overall, the breadth we've seen in, call it the new year, is actually, I think, independent of AI. You can make an argument across the industrial sector, the pharma sector, even the banking sector, what the addressable TAM is for AI. But the bottom line here is the market's broadening. I think the Fed is always more important. I recognize what AI has meant and what the semiconductors as a group have meant to the leadership of the market for the last 2.5 years. The last couple days, in fact, really over the last couple weeks, you've seen the SMH, the semiconductors, underperform the S&P by almost 8%. What does that mean? It means they've run really fast. The fact that NVIDIA was flat to up small today on a day when there could have been a lot of disappointment it's actually pretty impressive. But back to your question, I would tell you that I think the Fed's more important. I think tomorrow's meeting obviously is not expected to have a lot of fireworks, but the tone around the Fed is really that pivot in December that Powell, I think, probably will try to reverse a bit of tomorrow, I think has everything to do with the breadth we've seen in the stock market.
Thanks, Tim. Adam Kobasi, same question to you. More important, the AI mania or the Federal Reserve?
I think over the short run, you're going to see AI keep pushing stocks higher. It's actually kind of proven that even as three interest rate cuts have been removed from market forecasts, we're still within 10 points of a new all-time high in the S&P, pretty much solely because of AI hype. So I think over the short run, AI hype has been more important. But I think as you look a little bit further out, all eyes are on the Fed still, kind of like what Tim suggested. And, you know, the Fed pivot from December, which effectively felt like a victory speech, is now proving to be a premature statement from the Fed. Markets are guiding three interest rate cuts. If we're lucky, we're probably going to see less this year. And I think the question that everyone needs to answer is, if we're truly on track for a Fed pivot, why do we need to rush to cut interest rates in a market environment where core inflation is still double the Fed's long-term target and just about all the data is still pretty strong?
Yeah, listen, Tim, I mean, let's do a hot take, right? I mean, I don't think we're going to get a rate hike tomorrow, but given that we've seen increases in inflation, at least the numbers, maybe 1, maybe 2 months, that's it. I get it. No trend, change a year, some things going on there. That said, is it possible, not probable, but possible, we do not get any rate cuts in 2024?
I think it's highly improbable. And if you look, we've got 70 basis points of cuts priced in between now and year end. There's no question that policy, by definition, is restrictive now. Wherever we have core inflation, we know where rates are, and we know that slowly is driving with the brake on. I think the Fed will have to cut. I think there are hawks within the Fed that are going to keep the pressure on. I don't think they need to do anything. I think the balance sheet runoff is very significant right now as well. This is a Fed that understands that disinflation is still largely with us, but that February was the first move higher in core CPI we've had in months. Owner's equivalent rent, services inflation, some of these dynamics, and then you have the trickle in from energy, which everyone likes to write off. I think it feeds through. So it's going to be highly improbable that we get zero cuts in 24. I think the economy is proving to be, especially the labor market, like until that cracks, I don't see why the Fed has to be overly aggressive cutting rates, but they will cut.
You know, Adam, we did a two-part question, kind of our version of Fast Money's Would You Rather, but I think now we probably should have done a three-part question. And I'll add this to wrap it up. We talked about AI, we talked about the Fed, we got this thing called the election. I don't know if you heard about this, it's coming up in November. And I do wonder, like 2016, is it possible the market just kind of stalls out for the months heading into the election? Because let's be honest, there's trillions of dollars as well at stake. And I just wonder how much the election might play into how the market or if the market moves.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the election is going to have implications. We've seen in every election year. And I think right now we're at the point where there's so many market drivers that we might almost kind of just freeze up because markets don't even know what to follow. You have the Fed, you have AI, you have the election, you have geopolitical tensions, you have everything in between, all while we seem to be on track for a quote unquote soft landing. So it's hard to even say what's the primary driver anymore. But I think markets are still kind of leaning towards, even in the wake of all this noise, dips are being bought, the trend is strong, the economic data has been strong. And I think that buyers will continue to lead to new all-time highs in the equity markets as long as the data remains the way it is and nothing too crazy happens, which doesn't seem like we're seeing anything crazy right now compared to what we've been seeing over the last couple of years.
Adam, it's so early in the year. There's so much time for crazy. Adam Kobasi,
you know
Tim
that.
Seymour, thank you both very much. Tim,
thanks,
I love
Brian.
The outlet. Plug something in, man, just for fun. I'm in an energy
ground
cut.
Control
all
to
right,
Major
guys,
Tom. I'm in the airport.
Thank
you.
I love it. There you go. Safe
Sorry.
Travels wherever you're going, Tim. All right. Let's do a.
Thank
this
you,
is
buddy.
A weird story. Let's do a quick check on Chipotle. Yeah, the Tex-Mex chain. Shares are surging right now, up about 5%, $132 a share. That's the game. because Chipotle announced a 50-1, not a 5-1, not a 10-1, not a 3-1 or whatever, a 50-1 stock split. Now, it's got to be approved by shareholders. If it is, it will be Chipotle's first stock split and, of course, one of the biggest ever in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. It will take effect, if approved, in late June. Chipotle's been on a fire run, up more than 80% in the last year alone. It's at 2,930, but it's about to become that divided by 50, which I can't do in my head. I apologize. All right. We are just getting started live from the CERAWeek conference in Houston on deck. Chevron CEO Mike Wirth joins us exclusively on what is next in the rally in oil prices, energy demand, risk to supply, and much, much more. We're back right after this.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Nexco, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
All right, welcome back. We talk a lot about AI here on CNBC, especially lately. It's expected to be a massive driver of growth in technology and productivity, but all the semiconductors and massive data centers that actually power AI require something of their own. Power, meaning electricity, and a lot of it. We're going to show you just how much in the RBI coming up in a few minutes. But much of that power generation is going to come from natural gas. And the energy companies here at CERAWeek are excited about the prospect of AI. This all coming, by the way, as oil prices have popped lately, back above 80 bucks a barrel, demand growing, geopolitical tensions in the Middle East keeping traders on edge, even as American oil production hits new record highs. Let's talk about all of it. Joining us tonight for more is Chevron Chairman and CEO Mike Wirth, and we appreciate it. Mike, good to see you again.
Brian, good to see you.
Before we get into all that stuff, I got to ask you about this thing, because investors are watching, Guyana, Hess. You're buying Hess. They're partnered with Exxon in Guyana. Now Exxon is claiming this contractual right that maybe they've got the right to sort of steal that stake or whatever, take that stake from you. We talked to Darren Woods yesterday of ExxonMobil. What's Chevron's side of the Guyana dispute, Guyana Gate?
Well, look, we worked for a number of months privately and constructively with the partners in the Stabroek Block in Guyana to try to understand and address the differences of opinion on the language in this joint operating agreement. We thought we were making progress. We were trying to satisfy the needs that they had expressed and help them find a path to the outcomes that we understood they were looking for. And then a couple of weeks ago, those discussions came to an end, and we got a notice filed for arbitration. So that's the path that we're on right now. We're confident in our understanding of the contract. We're confident that the arbitration will affirm our understanding of the contract, and that seems to be the path to resolution of this.
All right, that's a little bit inside baseball. Let's talk about something more fun and sort of big picture. You just heard that setup on AI. I mean, people think of Chevron as an oil company. You're an energy company. You're doing a lot of different things. Are we overhyping it from an energy side, or will there really be this kind of demand growth because of this?
I think if you look at the fact that we were already in a pace to try to electrify a lot of the U.S. economy previously, we were seeing things like demand for cryptocurrency build up demand that hadn't been forecasted. And now, I talk to people that are in the AI business, and they actually talk about something that they describe as a triple exponential. This exponential growth in the power of the models, leading to an exponential growth in the number of use cases that people now can envision to use the technology, which is going to lead to an exponential growth in the need for data centers and ultimately the power for those data centers. I'm not sure that power demand is reflected in a lot of the thinking and the plans today with a grid that's already in many ways straining to meet the demands of the U.S. economy as it exists today.
Well, I will before answer, we see that. I mean, you can interview me. I will give you my answer, not that anybody cares. The answer is no. I mean, we've done story after story about how the grid is not ready. We're going to have to build out the grid, but we're also going to have to build out the pipes, the pipelines in some cases,
right.
Natural gas to power the plants, to power the AI. What's Chevron's, how do you, when you go into your board meetings and you meet with your management team, are you guys talking about AI?
Well, we're talking about AI because it can transform our business. We're also talking about AI in terms of driving energy demand here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. And we'll see a balance of sources of that power. But these data centers need 24/7 power 365, right? It's not just power when the wind's blowing or the sun's shining. And so we're going to have to find ways to meet that demand as an economy round the clock. And that means that there's going to be an increased role for natural gas, I think, versus what people might have seen just a few years ago. Wind and solar will be a part of that, but they won't be the entire answer. Batteries are not yet at a point where they can step in and carry that kind of demand load. Nuclear is still expensive and difficult to build in this country. You come back to natural gas.
It truly is amazing because we were talking a few years ago, and I didn't have Mike Worth talking about cryptocurrency on my bingo card, but I like to hear it. We were doing stories on CBC a couple years ago about how, is there enough energy to power crypto? Now you're going to layer AI on top of crypto. Everyone's like, yay, we're going to build these data centers. I mean, Amazon just bought one that's literally connected to a nuclear power plant. So how do you see the next 5 or 10 years for Chevron building out? Does that change the way you think about where you want to be physically, geologically, whatever it is?
I don't think in the short term it really changes that, Brian. I mean, the resources are laid down where they are. We've got a really strong position in the Permian Basin, particularly in the Delaware side, which tends to be a little bit gassier than the Midland part of the Permian Basin. And so I think what it means is what we see today, which are pretty low natural gas prices, are not likely to stay that way. LNG export facilities, a question, how many of those get built out, but certainly a number are approved and under construction. And then as these data centers get built, and they will, many of them will be built here in the United States, I think you see demand for gas is just going to grow, probably stronger even than our current forecast would call for.
I want to ask a quick global question because you guys are global. You got an operation in Kazakhstan. Obviously, you know what's going on in the Red Sea. I've been watching giant oil tankers, maybe some of them are yours, who knows, going around Africa because they're too afraid to go in to the Red Sea. You probably have the smartest people in the world working on this. How bad? Is it getting better? Is it staying the same? How bad is the geopolitical risk in that critical part of the world?
It's very tenuous right now, Brian. It can pivot on a dime. It seems as if some of the attacks we've seen out of Yemen have subsided to a certain degree. We're not moving ships through the Red Sea right now. We are moving them through the Arab Gulf. We had two ships attacked by Iran last year. One was commandeered by commandos that were dropped off of helicopters and taken into an Iranian port, and the crude oil was offloaded. A second one took fire for several hours before the Fifth Fleet showed up. So that region is fraught with risk always.
Yeah.
Today, the conflict in Israel and Gaza goes on. A resolution does not seem to be at hand, and the regional risks continue to be high.
So you're not putting ships through the Red Sea.
We're not putting ships through the Red Sea right now.
Yeah, and it adds time, it adds money, but it's also got to be from your perspective. You talk about getting boarded and your oil stolen by Iran. It's always been risky in certain parts, but it feels like we're at a real flashpoint here, Mike. I mean, how much does this occupy your time and your thinking with your board?
We talk about it. I mean, we've got security risk around the world, right? We're in Kazakhstan, close to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We're in Venezuela, soon to be in Guyana, near a border conflict there. We're in the Middle East. This is part and parcel of our business. We have professionals that understand these risks and work hard every day to mitigate them, but they're very real. And they're, the kinds of things that the market has been fairly well supplied for the last few years, and we've seen prices relatively stable, with the exception of when the war in Ukraine began. Yeah. We saw an excursion. But the system, you know, a disruption to a market that is firming, as you said, prices have been inching up. If we were to see a disruption today, you've got the risk for some more volatility.
Well, even the fairly bearish IEA actually just raised their oil demand estimates coming out of Paris to 103 million barrels a day. So that was a bit of a surprise. Always great to see you, Mike Wirth of Chevron. Thank you for sitting down and spending some time with us here live.
Good to be with you, Ryan.
Real pleasure. Thank you. All right, still ahead here on Last Call. What a very good day for oil and gas stocks. May reveal about the clean energy transition. We're going to hear from former BP CEO Bob Dudley. Plus, a ballot box showdown playing out tonight that could help determine part of crypto's fate. Stay with us.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
As the animation says, let's get down to tomorrow's news tonight. We're going to focus squarely on crypto because Bitcoin prices, they have seen a bit of a dip following their record highs. But right now, polls are closing any moment in the Ohio Senate primary election. And one pro-crypto Republican is looking to take on Democratic Senator and crypto critic Sherrod Brown. CNBC's Emily Wilkins, live in Ohio, with more. And I don't think, Emily, we've ever tied together an Ohio Senate race to Bitcoin before right now.
You know, we haven't, Brian, but I think 2024 is really going to be different here. As I said, it was at the polls on primary day in Ohio, and this is a state that could make or break who controls the Senate next year. And you're beginning to see companies like Coinbase and Ripple, they're all poised to target Ohio as part of a larger push to get crypto-friendly lawmakers into power. So currently, Ohio has their Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. He's the head of the Senate Banking Committee, and he's up for re-election. But he's also gotten an F from the crypto advocacy group Stand With Crypto. Meanwhile, one of the Republicans on the ballot today, a tech executive and blockchain evangelist, Bernie Moreno, has an A rating. And he tells me that if he wins, crypto is going to be on the ballot in the Ohio Senate race.
This will be an issue. You mark my words. You talk about 1.2 million people that own crypto here in Ohio, and they look at a guy like Sherrod Brown, this tired career politician that thinks he knows best, this will be an issue that we're going to use against him in his campaign.
A new crypto-supported PAC called Fairshake and two smaller related PACs have raised $85 million from groups like Coinbase, Ripple, Gemini, Andreessen Horowitz, and this is all as of the end of January. Fairshake spokesman John Velasto said the groups, quote, have the resources to affect the races and the makeup of institutions at every level, and said they will leverage those assets in order to build a sustainable, bipartisan crypto and blockchain coalition. But Brian, Sherrod Brown isn't the only Democrat in a key state that could be targeted. Stand With Crypto has also given an F rating to Montana Senator John Tester and Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, two other states that are going to be very critical in determining the balance of the Senate. And we're going to be seeing exactly how these crypto groups are going to play out in these key swing states for the rest of the primary as well as the general.
Emily Wilkins, Strongsville, Ohio. Emily, thank you very much. All right, so we just talked about Bitcoin and energy, so let's just kind of pivot back to energy because here we are live at the CERAWeek by S&P Global Conference in Houston, and it was a very good day for energy stocks. You're welcome. A number of big oil companies like Diamondback Energy, the original FANG, Marathon, Valero, and others hitting record or multi-year highs. So as calls for a transition to more clean energy have grown in recent years, is this a clue that maybe investors have been a little more keen on traditional energy? Let's ask a man who knows a thing or two about energy, the climate, and oil and gas's role in it, and also to try to help mitigate it. And that is former BP CEO Bob Dudley and now founder or chairman of the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, OGCI. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Good to see you, Brian.
Well, I'll just be blunt. Okay, the oil and gas companies, they talk about climate change. They talk a big game. Okay, but I'm going to meet a lot of smart people that will tell me that If oil and gas companies have anything to say about climate change, it's nothing more than horse pucky. I tried to keep it family friendly. Do oil and gas companies have a role in the fight against climate change?
Absolutely, they do. We just passed the 10th year of the OGCI, Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, had a roundtable today, and the targets that were set out by those companies 4 or 5 years ago have led to a reduction in their methane emissions, natural gas emissions, by 50%, 45% reduction in flaring, and taking the intensity down to 0.2, which is industry leading. So you have a group of big companies, 12 largest oil and gas companies in the world, across all geopolitical fault lines, NOCs and IOCs, responsible for 30% of the oil and gas, are completely committed to this, including setting up billion-dollar funds and investing in new technologies that will mitigate a real focus on methane, which is the low-hanging
methane's
fruit.
Methane's the enemy, right? Methane is, there's a lot of bad stuff, but methane is pretty much up there as like the worst thing.
It's also the low-hanging fruit to fix, you know, eliminating emissions. And, you know, 6 years ago in the field, you can't see it, you couldn't smell it, couldn't taste it. Even the workers didn't know that there were leaks going on. Not anymore. It's going to be not long before there's nowhere to hide with the new technologies of satellites, aircraft, drones, on-the-ground sensors. And then that's where taking that data and using it through AI to be able to analyze it quickly and report it, it's going to be a new world.
So we can use AI to help in the fight against methane and thus the fight against climate change. But we've just been talking about the last 2 days about how much demand for energy is going to boom because of AI, Bob. So we're going to have all this new need. A lot of it's going to be natural gas. Everybody admits that. How do we grow energy supplies without killing the planet?
Well, one is eliminate emissions from natural gas, and it's clean burning, combust it right. It's not a problem. That's what we need to do, is not eliminate the use of fossil fuels. We need to reduce emissions and do it fast, find it, fix it fast. And that's what's going to happen. It's going to be revolutionary. Now, you're right. People who are against natural gas, that is the reason, the great reduction in emissions in the United States, displacing coal. We're back to 1981 levels of emissions, and that natural gas.
Other countries aren't.
Not yet.
China, you know. Well, a couple hundred new coal plants coming on. I mean, climate change is global, Bob.
Correct.
You guys are doing good work at the OGCI. Is anybody over there listening in Beijing?
Well, one of the large Chinese companies is a member of OGCI.
So that's a start. That's good.
Yeah, and they've taken on an investment fund for clean energy. China's an interesting case because of the economic growth over the last 10 years or so, 20 years really. I mean, they're building nuclear power plants. They're building giant wind farms and solar. And coal, they need it for their population. And India is going to have similar issues going forward.
And they're listening?
Oh,
India
definitely.
Too?
Definitely listening, yes.
Yeah, because we can. The U.S. has done, I think, outside of smaller countries like a Norway or whatever, I think the U.S., is it fair to say, not to have some eagle on my shoulder, you know, that the U.S. has done as good of a job as any major industrial power, maybe along with Germany, although they got their own problems, at reducing emissions.
Correct.
And but it doesn't do us any good to do that if the other side of the world is getting worse.
Well, we're going to have the problem by 2050. Another billion people, new people, population-wise, a billion people today don't have access to even electricity.
Yeah.
So they're going to grow their economies, and they're all interested in how to do this clean energy. And when Russia invaded Ukraine, it was all about clean, affordable energy. But now we're back in a world where security of supply is important. So there's new dynamics, and you were talking with Mike Wirth about the geopolitical risks. Mm-hmm. That's part of the mix. And all the supply chains have to be redone all over.
A billion or so people who just want what we've had forever, which is for the light and the heat to come on and work, because it's a hard life in many parts of the world, and more people die of cold than die of heat. A lot of people don't realize that. Mm-hmm. Bob Dudley of the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, OGCI. I mean, you are the OG of
oil and gas.
We'll just call you the OG. Bob Dudley, thank you. All right, coming up, the AI boom delivering a big old barrel of reality for, you guessed it, American energy companies. But could it also deliver a lot more profit? CEO of ConocoPhillips on that and more next. go back to last call here at the CERAWeek conference in Houston. We are pleased once again to be joined by Ryan Lance. He is the chairman and CEO of ConocoPhillips. Ryan, great to see you again.
Thank you for joining us. Great to be here.
You know, so it's like the two A's. Last year when you were on, we talked all about Alaska. And your Willow project. This year, I feel like the A is AI. You might have heard about artificial intelligence. Yeah. NVIDIA's all over the CNBC screen today. And what I think investors don't fully realize or recognize is the role that companies like ConocoPhillips actually play in the AI revolution, because that energy, that power, electricity, has to come from somewhere. Is this something you guys talk about, or am I just way off base?
No, Brian. I mean, this is a germane topic to all of us right now. The energy needs over the course of the next couple of decades, driven by AI here in the United States, is going to be enormous. And I would tell you that over the next 5 to 10 years, the amount of gas-fired power generation going to be required to deliver that electricity to fire all the data warehouses that are going to be required is going to be enormous. One of the best spots, the biggest spots for investing in some of that infrastructure is going to be right here in the United States. So when you look at these data centers, the number of them they're trying to build, the size, scale, and scope, it's about power, it's about water. And they're no longer trying to locate them next to fiber cable. They'll bring the fiber, they want to locate it next to generating power, and it's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Yeah, and that's why we sort of tie it together, is that, you know, and unless you're building it next to a nuclear plant, and by the way, Amazon just bought this thing to do next to a nuclear plant, and you can have solar and you can power with wind, but you're going to need that baseload power. Absolutely. You're often going to have to even a backup natural gas plant. So my guess is the demand for natural gas for things like that is going to boom, but I'm also confused why the price of natural gas is $1.80.
Well, you know, the seeds for that were sowed 2 years ago, Brian. So coming out of COVID in 21, you know, the industry stopped basically when the demand fell so much, both for oil and the gas side of it. And then as the price started recovering in 2022, the rigs came back to work in the Haynesville, the Marcellus, and the Permian started growing again with its associated gas. So the seeds for what we're seeing today happened 2 years ago. And then the problem is we need to be thinking again what's going to happen 2 years from now. So things like the LNG pause only cause concern about what happens 2 years from now. So the reason the price is low today is all that drilling that came on, all the technology, all the associated gas with the Permian outstripped the demand. We had two warm winters in a row, and storage is at an all-time high, so prices have to fall. So what's happening? Rigs are coming offline. Supply will start to moderate a little bit. You throw some uncertainty with an LNG pause into the business, you're sowing the seeds for the next rally in the next couple of years. So you got to remember the time lag in the business.
What is the ConocoPhillips viewpoint on this, quote, LNG pause? Because what's confusing is that we had Secretary Granholm here yesterday, Secretary of Energy, saying basically we need to do this for climate reasons. We're going to take some time and study the data, but there's no timeline on it. What's your view on it and how long it might last?
Well, I don't have any insights into that. I don't think anybody does. I hope it's short. Look, they could have chosen to do something in parallel. They could have done an assessment while keep the permitting going. They chose to pause the permitting to do the assessment. There's nothing wrong with an assessment. I think that every now and then the government does need to take a look at the market and understand what's going on and is it doing the things that we thought. But you're living a real life assessment today with low prices and 13 BCF of exports that are happening today. So I think what the pause does is it caused customers to say, hey, those pricing agreements we've been negotiating with you, we're going to stall, we're going to slow down, we're going to stop. We don't know what the future has in store. So it gets tough to negotiate those today and with the uncertainty that created in the market. And again, and what do the drillers do when they see something that they don't know if there's going to be outlet to their gas? They're going to slow down. They're going to step back a little bit, right? And they need a price signal and a price rise in order to bring the rigs back to go. So it just seeds the volatility and it maintains that volatility. And the industry doesn't need that. Consumers don't need that. And frankly, the U.S. government doesn't need that either.
One thing we do hear from the government, I'm sorry to bring in politics, but it's an election year. We hear so much about oil and gas subsidies. As far as I can tell, and please, if I am wrong, correct me, you're the man that knows more about this than anybody. The quote subsidies that I hear about appear to me to be fairly common IRS deductions across that are allowable to any business doing certain type. Now there are some specific drilling, unused well. What's the real story? I know you're an oil and gas CEO. What's the real story around these subsidies that are being used as a political fireball?
Yeah, no. Unfortunately, in the wisdom of people, they called our expense of drilling the wells an IDC, an intangible drilling credit.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. That is no more different than any manufacturing credit or R&D credit the rest of business gets. It's primarily labor. It's over 80% expense. And everybody in the business, all businesses get to take their cash flow, deduct their expenses, calculate their profit, and then pay a percentage of that profit in taxes. So these deductions are our normal expense-driven deductions in our business. They're called something different uniquely for our business, but they're no different than manufacturing tax credits, R&D credits, the things that are normal in the business code. So my plea is just quit singling out our industry. If you want to do something to the tax code, do something to the tax code if you think you have the votes and the ability to go do that. But it's this constant singling out of our industry that we're just acting under the
tax code. If they're watching, I have great friends. I love you all. They're all very intelligent, multiple degrees in many cases. They're like, well, these evil oil and gas subsidies. I'm like,
there are none.
This is a normal. My dad was a corporate accountant for 30 years. Normal tax deduction available to any industry, correct?
They are. Okay. They are, absolutely.
Last on this, do we need a price on carbon?
Well, you know, we've advocated. So our company initially recognized burning of fossil fuels is contributing to global warming and the climate. And we originally were some of the original supporters of a cap and trade, the old Waxman-Markey bill. Yep. And we have matured our thinking that having a price on carbon probably is the best way to level the whole playing field. And but it's difficult to go do. Put a tax on carbon is difficult.
They're trying it in Europe, and they're kind of moving around.
If you want a demand signal and you want to start to impact the demand side of the equation, it's the only realistic way to let the market work and let the market re-equilibrate itself. But that's some of the problem right now. The policies are on the supply side of the equation, not on the demand side of the equation. So they're trying to pick winners and losers in this equation. And the result of that, it's not transparent to the consumer. Consumer has no idea what they're paying for it until their electricity prices triple, until the gasoline at the pump triples, or something happens in the volatility of the commodity. So it's a lack of that transparency. And what a carbon tax does is it makes it very transparent. But I understand how hard that is to do politically.
Much like the mystery subsidy that we keep hearing about. But it's great to clear that up.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people don't want to hear it, but the truth can be ugly sometimes.
Yeah.
Ryan Lance, Chair and CEO of ConocoPhillips, really appreciate it.
Thank
Montana's
you,
finest.
Yeah.
Ryan, thank
yeah,
you very
you,
much. Ryan. All right, coming up after the break, this whole conference was basically started by one guy. His name is Dan Yergin, probably the most famous energy researcher and author in the world, and he's going to be your guest next. All right, time for today's RBI. It's back. And as we teased earlier, right now it's about electricity, specifically whether we'll be able to make enough of it to power America's goals. It's a growing problem that is finally getting more of the attention it deserves. Of course, a huge driver of this exploding demand comes from data centers used to run the internet and AI. Data centers are, in many ways, the backbone of the entire digital economy. No data centers, bye-bye AI boom. But really, just how much energy they require is actually mind-blowing. Listen to this. A study by McKinsey last year estimates that just one large data center can use as much power as 80,000 average-sized American homes. McKinsey also predicts data center power demand will nearly double by the end of just this decade. Bottom line, it's going to be a Herculean task for utilities and other energy providers to try to keep up. Yep, some of that power will come from wind, from solar, maybe even small nuclear. But like it or not, most of that generating capacity, at least in the next few years, will likely come from natural gas-fired power plants, which is one reason so many oil and gas executives here are bullish. It doesn't take AI to figure out that they who hold the power, literally and figuratively. One data center, 80,000 homes. Random, but important. Joining us now tonight from the S&P Global CERAWeek Conference is Vice Chairman Daniel Yergin. He's also the chairman and host of CERAWeek. This is your baby. How many years is this now, Dan?
It's several decades.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Just, you said about 10 years ago, there was 3,000 attendees. There's over 9,000 today. I've been coming, not for multi-decades, but over 10 years. I have never seen the executives more bullish than they are today. Are you kind of getting that same sense?
I think I'm not sure if I would say bullish, but they do see that there is, where before people were thinking energy demand is going down, which is what you thought during COVID, it's recognition is going up. And you were just talking about data centers. If a year or two ago, you would have said electricity is going up because of electrification, EVs and so forth.
Which
now,
it is.
Yeah, and now on top of it, you put this data explosion and AI, and just one of the major tech companies say they're opening a new data center every 3 days. May take 2 years to build, but every 3 days, and that's just one of them. So suddenly, we've heard from utility executives who used to think about demand flat going down, say, how are we going to meet it? Can we get it permitted? Yeah. And then, of course, you know, they're going to need gas turbines to support it,
so
as well as
wind
and solar.
The numbers you just said that layered nicely onto our RBI, we didn't even plan this, by the way. One data center every 3 days. So call that 100 new data centers. That's based on what we just talked about, 80,000 homes per one data center. We're talking, combine that by multiple companies, Google, Facebook, whatever. We're effectively building new cities worth of electricity
right.
demand every year.
Yeah. So this is going to mean you're going to need more power. Where the power is really critical. Of course, at the same time, there'll be the efforts to drive down the electricity demands of the new chips. But we're in a different, it's really a different ball game. It's how do you meet growth?
Yeah. And NVIDIA's CEO said, yeah, they're trying to use less energy per, you know, functionality, but yet the chip they just rolled out is 1,000 times more powerful than just 8 years ago. It's truly remarkable. You got the permitting issues, though. I mean, there are roadblocks in this epic journey.
Yeah, whether you're talking about...
Senator Manchin talked about that yesterday.
That's right. Whether you're talking about electric transmission lines, or you're talking about natural gas pipelines, whether you're talking about the mines that you need to produce copper, everybody's just stymied about permitting. And Senator Manchin said he's going to try and get it done in this session. But that is a challenge to, you know, to get things built in America.
I hate to end it on a more grim note, but obviously Russian invasion of Ukraine, Putin's insane war, now more than 2 years old. Ukraine, though, punching back, launching drone attacks inside Russia, hitting some Russian refineries. Not exactly sure how much is offline. Maybe you know. If you do, tell us. You got Houthis lobbing missiles at ships and U.S. and U.K. military ships. Feels like we're on the razor's edge right here, Dan.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you can go through three or four different things that could happen. You know, you have accidents happen or things happen, and you can hit something that just causes it to explode. War here, and then a third war, which is the Iranian proxy war, which the Houthis. So it is a dangerous time. And you can see the price of oil today is up because of these Russian refineries, which are about 16% of capacity. And what's particularly smart about what the Ukrainians did from their point of view. These are two of the refineries supply Moscow and central Russia, so there will be an impact as opposed to Siberia or somewhere else. So it is a precarious time, and it would be good if our own political system was responsive, and of course we have an election.
How should we respond?
Well, I think we need coherence. Obviously, one thing is supporting Ukraine at this time. The administration is trying to get to a ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, as you say, the Red Sea is not a dead sea, but it's certainly a lot of the traffic is down. And we heard from one of the CEOs that on a day-by-day basis, they make decisions whether their tanker goes through the Red Sea or not.
Yeah, and we'll leave it there. But Mike Wirth told us right now they are not putting their oil or their ships through the Red Sea at Chevron because of that risk, which is, by the way, also inflationary because it's adding costs to that shipment. Amazing conference. I know it gets bigger and better every year, Dan. Thanks for having CNBC again. We really appreciate it.
Good to have you here, Brian.
Thank you. Congrats on your success. All right, coming up, the biggest surprises so far from CERAWeek. Pippa Stevens will be up next with that. All right, we're here with our colleague Pippa Stevens because you've been in and out of pretty much every session the last couple of days. Appreciate it. I'm just feeding off your knowledge. What are the biggest surprises to you? And I don't know, so surprise me.
Well, Brian, I think the biggest surprise is security of supply. And we see this across all forms of energy, across every single vertical. And it's a theme that I've heard in basically every single panel. So of course, there's the obvious cases like the LNG pause and what does that mean? But there's also things like disappointment around the recent hydrogen guidance from Treasury, even when it comes to mining. How are we going to have the copper? How are we going to build out these supply chains that aren't looking towards tomorrow, but looking towards the next decade? And I think that a lot of the times, you know, investors, people like that, maybe focus on the here and now. But in reality, these systems are slow. There are trillions of dollars on the line, and it is really long term. And making sure that we build out that necessary infrastructure in all, you know, areas of energy is a common theme and a really important topic here.
It's also the last mile. You've talked about and covered this permitting problem. I mean, what's it, Field of Dreams? If you build it, they will come. Yeah, you can build it, but if you can't get it to somebody, it doesn't work. It doesn't matter. So
exactly.
I would imagine that's a huge thing. What else has kind of surprised you the last couple of days and what you've heard?
So you've talked all about the power boom from AI. But
well, I had to. It's the NVIDIA stuff.
So yeah, of course. But I think beyond that, we also need to remember that energy and utility companies have been using AI for decades. They have so much data they're harnessing every single day. Think about a lateral well now. It can be almost 4 miles. In order to get that drill bit to go the 4 miles you want, think about the precision you need, the technology you need. And so sometimes I think that energy and utilities are kind of seen as maybe backward-looking companies and are left out of this technology revolution. But in reality, they are using so much of that. They're integrating so much of that. And then finally, I think kind of getting all stakeholders together, that's been another big theme here about partnering and kind of companies understanding where they fit into the energy transition or evolution, as one person told me, and then working together towards this bigger, bigger push towards the grid, the energy sector of the future.
A couple years ago, the mood here was grim. It was like, we're phasing them out. Hydrocarbons are dead. Now it's super optimistic. Everybody's talking about crypto and AI and 4 mile long lateral well drills using AI. It's all very good stuff. We'll leave it there, Pippa Stevens. And by the way, you talked about stakeholders. I know our awesome crew here, everybody, in about 20 minutes, we're going to be stakeholders, STEAK, right, guys? Because it is Texas. So we're owe for a good dinner. But Pippa, thank you. Thanks for hanging around late. Really appreciate that. Pippa Stevens here at CERAWeek. Folks, thank you all for watching. Last call from CERAWeek. Again, lot of talk about just more of everything all the time. I'll see you back in studio tomorrow night, assuming, you know, we get there safely. So have a great one. Take care. See you tomorrow.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Next, don't give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.